There's nothing quite like that moment of pure, unadulterated panic when you sit down at a really formal dinner.
Oh, yeah, the multi-course ones.
Exactly. And
Yeah.
you realize you have absolutely no idea which fork to use. I mean, you're staring at like three different sized spoons, this baffling array of glassware, and suddenly you just feel like a total imposter.
Right, the intimidation factor in those spaces is just immense because you want to belong, you know.
Totally.
You're thrilled to be invited to the table, but the fear of doing the wrong thing, like accidentally drinking for the finger bowl or whatever, it completely paralyzes you. So you just end up faking it.
Yeah, you just fake it so you don't stick out. And that quiet internal panic is actually our starting point for this deep dive today. So if you're joining us, you are part of our family here at Harmony Christian Church, and our mission today is highly specific.
Extremely specific.
We are unpacking Pastor Kent Wagner's latest sermon, and the goal is to get you completely prepped, primed, and ready for your upcoming Connect Group discussion.
Which is huge because we really have a lot of crucial ground to cover for the Connect Groups this week. We're in the thick of the Kingdom Multiplies series, specifically the Tell Someone subseries.
Right.
And with Easter approaching so rapidly, Kent really, he dialed up the urgency on this one.
He really
Yeah,
did.
he challenged the church to fill the empty chairs around us using that incredibly sharp phrasing. He said, "We want to steal people from hell, not from other churches."
Ted, I thought about that line for days. It's so good. But to actually do that, to invite people into this community, we have to answer a really grounded question first.
Yeah, that core dilemma.
Exactly. Kent framed the central theme of the message around this. What do we actually do once we've accepted Jesus's invitation to sit at the table?
Right. And to illustrate that, Kent took us back to his days as a 19-year-old youth intern, which, by the way, he openly admitted that putting a teenager in charge of children's ministry was probably a terrible idea, a terrible administrative decision, yeah. But part of his compensation for that summer was that different church members would feed him dinner every night.
Which is how we get to night one. He goes to the home of a 70-year-old widow in the congregation. And I mean, the picture he painted of this house was so incredibly vivid.
Oh, the grandfather clock.
Yes, you can practically hear the ticking grandfather clock echoing in the quiet living room and see those handmade afghans draped over every single piece of furniture,
And the bird noises.
the random bird noises from the cage in the corner. It was perfect.
So he's sitting there making polite conversation, fully anticipating this massive, hearty spread of classic Midwestern grandma food.
Right, a feast to cap off his first day.
Instead, she brings out this tiny salad plate. And sitting right in the middle of it is a completely bare wedge of lettuce.
Just lettuce.
No dressing, no croutons, literally just a quarter of a head of iceberg lettuce.
That is so bleak.
And then next, she brings out a massive steaming bowl of vegetable soup, which Kent secretly hates, and a gigantic glass of tomato juice, which he also hates.
Because when the church asked for his dietary restrictions, he literally just said peas, so he walked right into this trap.
Exactly. So the sheer culinary awkwardness of sitting across from a near stranger with a dry wedge of lettuce is just palpable.
He's internally panicking, right? Asking himself, like, what is the procedure for this? He doesn't want to offend her, so he just stalls.
He just watches her.
Yeah, he watches the widow. And eventually, she picks up her bare lettuce and dunks it straight into her vegetable soup.
Like a piece of bread.
Like bread, it's such a phenomenal, slightly bizarre image.
It really is, but it operates as a perfect mirror for this much deeper spiritual reality that plays out in our pews every single Sunday.
Yeah, because my initial thought when hearing that story was how perfectly it captures that first day on the job imposter
Oh,
syndrome.
for sure.
You go through the interview, you accept the offer, you sit down at your shiny new desk, and then you realize you have zero clue what your actual daily tasks are.
Right, you've accepted the job. You're officially at the table with Jesus, but you have no idea what the daily expectations entail.
Which leads directly to that tragedy Kent highlighted. Because of that exact brand of spiritual imposter syndrome, churches actually, well, they inadvertently incentivize lying.
They do. And I want to dig into that because it's a heavy accusation, but it feels painfully accurate.
Yeah, unpack that a bit.
Well, we've adopted this warped cultural idea that being a Christian simply means being a good person. We treat it like a moral checklist.
Like, follow the rules, don't mess up.
Exactly.
Yeah.
We assume the daily tasks are praying more, reading the Bible more, maybe knocking on some doors, and definitely trying to stop sinning.
Right.
But when someone sits at the table, does all those things, and still feels spiritually hollow or confused, the fear of ostracization kicks in.
Because we don't want to look like the one bad Christian in the room who doesn't get the joke.
So we lie. We pretend we know exactly what we are doing.
We mindlessly throw our hands up during the worship music just because, you know, the person in the row ahead of us is doing it.
Nobody wants to raise their hand and admit they're staring at a spiritual wedge of lettuce with no idea how to consume it.
That tension is so real. The desperate desire to have people join the table versus the absolute necessity of them actually understanding the meal they're sitting down for.
Right.
And we saw that on full display during the Ben Fuller concert the other night.
Oh, man, if you missed that concert, it was an unbelievable night.
Such a great night. Massive shout out to Sean and the whole team who organized it. But the defining moment, I think, was when Ben Fuller told Sean he wanted to do impromptu baptisms during the set.
Yeah, and Ben's team asked if Harmony was okay with that, and Harmony immediately said yes.
Without hesitation.
Which is crazy because Ben's team noted that Harmony was an outlier there. They mentioned that several other churches had flatly refused to allow impromptu baptisms on the tour.
And at first glance, a church saying no to baptisms sounds completely backwards. Like, isn't that the point?
You'd think so.
But Kent explained the underlying fear those other churches have. They are terrified that people are making a purely emotional decision in the heat of a concert without being truly ready.
They don't want people blindly saying yes to a free meal without knowing the demands of the host.
Exactly. Which is why Kent utilizes a very specific safeguard when he's back there doing those baptisms. He asks the standard question, you know, do you believe Jesus is the Christ, the Son of the living God?
And everyone says yes to that.
Right. But then he intentionally follows it up with a second question. Do you want to make him the boss of your life?
I love that. Using the word boss is such a brilliant pattern interrupt.
It really is.
It's not traditional biblical phrasing, but it forces people out of their autopilot religious responses. Mm-hmm. It demands that they recognize they aren't just joining a social club.
Right. They are stepping into a hierarchy where they actually take instructions.
And that desire to just sit at the table and enjoy the perks without knowing the host or accepting the boss, that isn't a modern church problem.
Not at all.
Jesus ran into this exact same dynamic 2,000 years ago.
Mm.
And the context of John chapter 6 illustrates it perfectly.
Yeah, the historical context Kent provided for John 6 fundamentally shifted how I read that chapter.
Oh, it changes everything.
It really strips away the stained glass window version of Jesus and shows us his profound, relatable humanity.
Because the emotional weight Jesus is carrying at the start of this narrative is just staggering.
Right. His cousin, John the Baptist, has just been murdered, and it wasn't just an execution.
It was a spectacle.
Yes. A brutal, theatrical beheading at a sycophant party thrown by King Herod. Herod's niece dances seductively. Herod makes a rash promise to give her anything, and she asks for John's head on a platter.
It is a grotesque, deeply traumatic loss for Jesus' family.
Unimaginable grief.
And experiencing that fully human grief, Jesus seeks isolation. He gets into a boat to cross the Sea of Galilee, desperately needing a quiet place to just process the death of his cousin and the increasing hostility of the political landscape.
But the isolation never comes. He steps out of the boat on the other side and is met by an unfathomable crowd.
Kent noted there were 5,000 men plus women and children.
So we are talking about a crowd of potentially 20,000 people.
And the analogy Kent used grounds that number perfectly. He compared it to walking into Rupp Arena when the Wildcats are playing.
Oh, man, imagine navigating that sheer volume of people all buzzing, all demanding something from you while you are in the depths of personal mourning.
If I'm grieving a family member and 20,000 people show up wanting to solve their problems, I'm turning the boat around.
100%. Hand me the oars.
But Jesus looks at this massive crowd, sees them as sheep without a shepherd, and his compassion just overrides his grief. Instead of sending them away, he feeds them.
Which leads to some of the most spectacular miracles in the scriptures. The disciples are panicking about how to cater Rupp Arena with a boy's lunch of 5 loaves of bread and 2 fish.
Right.
But Jesus prays over it, and the creative force of God multiplies the physical matter to feed everyone until they are stuffed.
And Jesus actually equated that moment to God providing manna in the desert for the Israelites. And Kent dropped a fascinating linguistic detail there.
Oh, about the translation.
Yeah, the Hebrew word manna literally translates to, what is it?
The ultimate mystery meal.
Exactly. And the supernatural display continues that very night. Jesus finally escapes up the mountain to mourn alone, sends the disciples across the lake, and when a life-threatening storm hits their boat, he walks across the water to save them.
Even pulling Peter out of the waves.
Right. The narrative momentum there is incredible. But the pivotal insight, the whole reason we are looking at this story to understand our own church experience, happens the very next morning.
When the crowd tracks Jesus down on the other side of the lake.
Yes. You would expect Jesus to be thrilled by their dedication, right? But he actually calls them out.
He pierces right through their religious performance. He tells them, "You aren't looking for me because you saw the miraculous signs. You're looking for me because you ate the loaves and had your fill."
Kent joked that they were coming back because they got free Chick-fil-A and wanted to hit the jackpot again.
They just wanted the chicken sandwich. They didn't cross the lake searching for spiritual truth or a new boss. They just wanted another free lunch.
So they're sitting at the table with Jesus, wanting the benefits of his power. And they ask the exact same question we ask today when we feel that imposter syndrome.
Right.
They ask, what must we do to do the works God requires?
It's the wedge of lettuce question all over again. What are the rules here? How do I eat this?
And Jesus's answer completely subverts their expectations. He says, the work of God is this, to believe in the one he has sent.
The work is to believe.
That's it, to believe.
Okay, I have to play devil's advocate here and push back on this because it feels contradictory to what we just said.
How so?
Well, believe sounds like a passive internal feeling, but just a few minutes ago, we established that Kent makes people agree Jesus is the boss of their life.
Right.
Submitting to a boss sounds like an active daily grind of requirements. How can the actual work just be a passive belief?
And that perceived contradiction trips up so many modern Americans.
Right.
We tend to view belief as mere intellectual assent. Like, yeah, sure, I agree that fact is true.
Right.
But to unravel why belief is actually the hardest work you can do, we really have to look at Kent's airplane analogy.
Oh, that analogy clarified the concept instantly for me.
It's so good.
Yeah.
When you or I get on a commercial flight, how do we handle the mandatory safety presentation?
We tune it out completely.
Entirely.
We throw our noise-canceling headphones on, close our eyes, and completely ignore the flight attendant pointing out the emergency exits.
Because we acknowledge that air travel is statistically safe. It's a mental fact we agree with. But Kent brought up a friend of his, a rather large guy, who will readily acknowledge the statistics that flying is the safest form of travel. He knows the facts. But if you try to physically get him onto an airplane...
Kent said he will take you downtown Jackson Brown.
Yes. You would literally have to tranquilize him and hogtie him to drag him onto the jet bridge.
Which is wild.
But the distinction there is vital. He acknowledges the safety of the plane in his intellect, but he does not truly believe it.
Right. Because if he truly believed it, he would behave differently. He would casually walk onto the plane and put his headphones on like the rest of us.
That shifts the entire definition of the word. True, biblical belief isn't just a mental nod of agreement to a set of historical facts. It's a conviction that is so deeply rooted, as Kent phrased it, down to your toenails, that it fundamentally alters the way you operate in the world.
Wow. Yeah, if we only acknowledge Jesus, but don't possess that down-to-the-toenails belief, our natural impulses don't change.
They don't.
And because our impulses remain the same, we feel the need to force our behavior. We manufacture a checklist to try and act like a good Christian, which brings us right back to lying and imposter syndrome.
Exactly. When you truly believe, the outward actions naturally flow from that internal reality. The work isn't the checklist. The work is cultivating the belief.
And the mechanics of how we actually build that kind of deep belief is where this sermon got incredibly fascinating for me.
Oh, the science part.
Yes. Ken didn't just give us a theological platitude. He brought in the actual neuroscience.
The intersection of biology and faith. He introduced two critical scientific concepts, neuroplasticity and long-term potentiation.
Right. And the fundamental idea of neuroplasticity is that your brain isn't just a static, hardwired machine. It literally physically changes its structure based on repeated use.
That's amazing.
I kept thinking of it like a social media algorithm. If you casually click on one video of a golden retriever on a skateboard, suddenly your entire feed is flooded with extreme sports bets.
You're doomed to dog videos.
Exactly. And your brain functions the exact same way. It physically restructures itself to feed you more of what you click on in your daily thoughts.
And the mechanism behind that restructuring is long-term potentiation. To put it simply, neurons that fire together wire together.
Okay, unpack that a little.
Sure. Yeah. Every time you focus on a specific thought, a chemical signal passes across the synapse between your brain cells. Long-term potentiation is the biological process where those synaptic connections actually get stronger and more efficient the more you use them.
Okay.
It's like walking through a dense forest. The first time you push through the brush, it's difficult. But if you walk that exact same path every single day, you eventually trample down the weeds and it becomes a smooth, effortless dirt trail.
And that physical rewiring is why Kent used the UK Wildcats as an example, isn't it?
Exactly. He asked the congregation who could rattle off player stats going all the way back to Jack Gibbons, or recite trivia about our coach Mark Pope from his playing days.
And people can do it instantly.
Right, because people spend hundreds of hours focusing their brain power on basketball. Their neural pathways regarding the Wildcats have been reinforced into superhighways.
Or consider the red car syndrome Kent mentioned. If you decide you want to buy a red Jeep, suddenly you see red Jeeps at every intersection in Georgetown.
Everywhere.
The city didn't magically import a fleet of them overnight. Your brain simply pruned away other visual data to prioritize the thing you told it to care about.
Because the human brain defaults to whatever is easiest. That's why the crowd in John 6 wanted the bread. It requires zero neurological effort. A free meal is a survival jackpot.
Right.
But rewiring your brain through long-term potentiation requires immense cognitive energy.
Which is exactly why the Apostle Paul's writings are so profound. Paul had never heard the word neuroplasticity 2,000 years ago, but he understood the psychological mechanics perfectly.
He really did?
In Romans chapter 8 and Colossians chapter 3, Paul writes a very specific command. Set your minds on things above.
Notice he didn't say do more good deeds. He targeted the mind. He explained that if you set your mind on your flesh, the neural pathways that learn to crave bourbon more than the Bible, or the paths that find more joy in workplace gossip than in extending grace, you will reap death from those overgrown trails.
Wow.
But if you intentionally focus your thoughts on the Spirit, you reap life and peace.
And Josh's testimony from last week was the living embodiment of this. Kent highlighted how Josh went from a man who obsessively thought about building his own kingdom to a man who now constantly focuses on God's kingdom.
Right.
He didn't just change his schedule, he changed his mental diet, and his brain physically rewired him into a completely transformed man.
So, to apply this neuroscience directly to the Connect group discussions this week, the solution to the awkward wedge of lettuce is not adopting a heavier burden of religious chores.
No, it's turning your mind's energy toward learning the heart of the host.
Exactly. When you open the Gospels of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, you aren't just reading ancient history. You are walking a new path in the woods.
I love that.
You look for the heart of God. What angers him? Who does he show mercy to? How does he react to failure? If you intentionally focus your cognitive energy there, long-term potentiation takes over.
And your brain physically rewires itself to see his kingdom everywhere, just like the red Jeep.
Exactly. The actions of a good Christian will naturally follow because your deep, down-to-the-toenails belief has fundamentally changed your biological wiring.
Which brings us right back to the dinner table with the 70-year-old widow. Kent finally gave us the resolution to that excruciating meal.
Oh, the tomato juice standoff.
Yes. He was staring down that giant glass of tomato juice. He calculated that if he drank the whole thing, she would assume he loved it and serve it to him every single week of the internship.
A nightmare.
But if he didn't drink any of it, he would offend her hospitality. So, relying on his polite Kansas upbringing, he drank exactly half of the giant glass.
The perfect compromise.
Right. It was just enough to be respectful, but left enough behind to clearly signal, please do not pour me anymore.
And the way Kent tied that ending to our modern faith is a crucial warning for our church family.
Yeah, let's talk about that.
Well, due to toxic teachings, or just cultural misunderstandings of the Bible, so many people view God purely as a cosmic rule enforcer. They picture him as a grumpy host, serving up bland vegetable soup and bitter tomato juice, demanding that we eat it to prove our loyalty.
And because they possess that warped view of the host, they only drink half the cup of Christianity.
Exactly. They do just enough to maintain polite appearances, just enough to soothe their conscience and avoid hell, but they don't actually desire any more of what God is pouring.
But Kent dismantled that image entirely. God isn't serving bitter vegetable soup. God has placed the equivalent of a prime Malone steak in front of you.
Or the ultimate root beer float.
Yes. He is offering living water that is so deeply satisfying, you will be scraping the bottom of the glass asking for a refill. It's water that will literally gush out of you, overflowing to everyone in your life.
So as you head into your Connect groups this week, that is the evaluation you need to make. Are you just drinking half the cup?
Right.
Are you merely acknowledging the safety of the airplane? Or are you actively learning the heart of the host and letting that belief rewire your daily existence?
That is the work.
It is. And before you head to your meeting, I want to leave you with one final thought to mull over regarding this intersection of neuroscience and faith.
Okay, lay it on us.
We discussed how our brains physically restructure themselves based on the thoughts we repeatedly focus on, how long-term potentiation builds those superhighways in the mind.
The paths in the woods.
Right. Consider the media diet you consume Monday through Saturday. If we spend 160 hours a week walking the neural pathways of cultural outrage, political anxiety, and mindless digital entertainment, we are actively pruning away the synapses designed for awe, peace, and spiritual depth.
Wow.
If we wire our brains for junk food all week long, why are we surprised when Sunday's Malone steak tastes like cardboard to us?
We've literally destroyed our ability to taste it. That is so challenging, but so true.
If you want to fill those empty Easter chairs Kent talked about,
yeah,
it begins with what you are feeding your own mind today.
Absolutely. Well, enjoy the discussions in your Connect groups, Harmony. We'll catch you on the next deep dive.